I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, spies are coming in from the cold, and more, these former agents are now working for corporate America. But first, some of the news today. We've been hearing for weeks concerns that a real economic slowdown is upon us, that a recession is near or maybe even here. The key, we've been told, would be consumer spending. Well, today, department stores such as Ann Taylor, Macy's, and Target announced weaker-than-expected December results. Will that cause consumers to spend even less in the months ahead? Boston Globe business reporter Jen Abelson joins us on the line. And Jen, you wrote about consumer spending for today's newspaper before these numbers came out. What are your thoughts on the numbers?
Well, they are weak and they are difficult for retailers. Consumers clearly tighten their purse strings this holiday season, and we're feeling the squeeze of various different pressures from the economy, from weakened jobs, from decreased discretionary spending.
We heard over the weekend about new unemployment figures up at 5%. But put these spending numbers in perspective for us. Why is consumer spending so important?
Consumer spending is so important because it accounts for about 70% of the economy. And so without consumers out there spending, buying homes, buying goods, there's not much left to the economy, and the economy depends on them.
Well, it becomes a ripple effect, but does it also become a self-fulfilling prophecy? If people hear, gee, other people aren't spending, do they stop spending?
Sure, it affects consumer confidence, and folks who are actually feeling the squeeze, they might be out there, you know, restricting their budget, but then those who are in a more comfortable position get anxious, get nervous, and start restraining their spending as well, and that's what I found.
Well, I heard an economist this morning say that he doesn't like to talk about whether there's a recession because it does become, you know, self-fulfilling. But we do want to get a little bit of information here. You know, are economists comparing what's happening now to any other years when there was a recession?
Well, growth in consumer spending this year, some economists say, is expected to drop to 1.9% from 2.9% in 2007. And that's according to Global Insight in Lexington, and economists there said the last time spending slowed that much was in 2001. And the only time spending growth was lower than that, lower than 1.9%, was in 1991. And in both years, the country was in the middle of recession. And some economists are even predicting that there'll be no growth in consumer spending this year, which did not happen in 2001.
Well, and what is the impact of, you know, consumer spending combined with all the other issues, the housing market slump? What is the impact? I mean, what are some of the things you start to see in the economy?
There are a number of conspiring, you know, factors going on right now. We're seeing rising prices at the gas pumps. We're seeing rising prices at the grocery stores. People are holding back. They're being influenced by the credit market. They aren't able to borrow as much as they were for years. Consumers were tapping into their home equity lines. They were able to afford mortgages that they probably shouldn't have gotten. And they were able to go out and spend new additions for their homes, buy new clothes. And all of that has a ripple effect, and consumers no longer are able to do the kind of spending that they were. I have a family that I interviewed yesterday who took out a home equity line, and they built an addition for their home, but now they're leaving their SUV in their newly built garage because they can't really afford to drive it that much.
Right. There are a few bright spots. We should point out that holiday sales at Walmart, Costco, TJ Maxx, some of the low-priced stores, exceeded analyst expectations. So what does that say to you?
Sure. Those retailers, Walmart, TJX, they typically do well in an environment where consumers are tightening their purses. And other ones that we've seen, Macy's and other department stores and high-end Nordstrom, I mean, they saw big drops in their sales. One analyst said that 66% of retailers missed what were, for many, already lowered expectations.
Well, the recession word is getting batted about. Mark Zandi, who's with MoodysEconomy.com, often comes on this program, says the economy is on the edge of recession, if not already engulfed in one. Yesterday, Goldman Sachs joined Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley in predicting a recession this year. And by the way, a recession typically defined as two quarters of economic contraction or this real slowdown. It doesn't sound as if people know whether or not we're in one or definitely headed for one, but do they know if there is going to be one, how long it will last?
Most economists have said that if we are entering one, they predicted the economy to contract modestly through the late 2008 and followed by a gradual recovery in the course of 2009. That said, people don't really know.
Jen Abelson, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Jen, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
The phrase, the spy who came in from the cold, is literal. It means agents who are pulled out of field operations, but it's taking on new meaning. According to journalist Douglas France, increasingly spies are coming in from the cold and going into corporate espionage. In an article in Condé Nast Portfolio magazine, France makes the case that the spies have moved into the business world because competition between corporations has replaced Cold War rivalries, and also because of post-9/11 disillusionment within the spy agencies. Douglas France, you'll remember, was with us the day after the assassination of Benazir Bhutto to talk about the Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan, who sold nuclear secrets to countries like Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Doug's book is The Nuclear Jihadist. Well, he joins us again from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington with more on corporate espionage, spies leaving intelligence agencies to work for corporations. Doug, is this an international trend?
It is indeed an international trend. With the collapse of the Cold War, we saw, I think, the first big influx of intelligence agents, particularly American intelligence agents, into the world of corporate espionage. And since then, we've seen a number of British firms set up by former MI6 and MI5 agents there. And most interestingly, I think, is a firm in Arlington, Virginia, called Trident Group, which is an American firm, but it's comprised of former Soviet military officers and KGB officers, and it was set up to help American companies navigate their way through the fjords of business in Moscow and other parts of Russia. You know, it's really a global phenomenon, although I think we see it most in the United States, really.
Well, and so they're forming their own consulting companies and also being hired by companies. What are some of the kinds of things that former spies, now at corporations, are being asked to do?
Well, in a way, they're asked to do the same things that they did as spies, and that's, I think, where the problem comes in. We've had for a long time in this country and elsewhere private investigators who specialized in digging up secret information. Some of them were involved in messy divorce cases. Others were involved in the straightforward aspects of due diligence. When a corporation intends perhaps to take over another corporation, these private investigators go out and they look through court records, they look through other publicly available records, and they report back to the acquirer about the veracity of the claims made by the potential investment target. And that's one thing. That's always been there. But I think in the last decade or so, since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and certainly since 2001, we've seen more agents come out and they bring sophisticated techniques that they used when spying for the United States government, and they bring those techniques to bear for corporate companies in spying on customers, on competitors, on potential acquisitions, and on their own employees. There's a most interesting case that I write about in the story involving Walmart. Mm. Walmart has a large internal security department, which is comprised of former FBI and CIA agents, former policemen. It's headed by a former senior CIA official, and they managed to get hold of private emails sent by two of their executives.
These two executives were fired for carrying on an affair through email in the company. Well, we know that emails that you send at a company are owned by the company. I mean, that's not new, and that there are hard drives and there are technical support people who can find this material. Why would you need, the former top member of the CIA to find out things like this? I mean, is some of this, shooting at a gnat with a cannon? Or did they really bring, extra expertise that found things that others couldn't have found?
Well, that's a good point, Robin, and it may be that in this case they didn't need this kind of firepower. But in many other cases, we're finding very sophisticated corporate espionage being conducted on a global basis. A lot of these former CIA agents specialize in obtaining information in countries where there aren't public records or where the public records that exist might not be trustworthy, places that are opaque for doing business, like Russia, like China, like Africa, places like that where you can't just walk into the courthouse or walk into the Securities and Exchange Commission and find out everything you want to know about a potential business partner. And so what I found in reporting this is that they've used the same skills that they developed for the government to go out, and in many cases they use even the same contacts to go out on behalf of their new employers, these corporations that are trying to do business all over the world.
Give us an example of that.
There was a New York-based company that acquired a hotel in the Caribbean. And they acquired it in partnership with the man who owned the hotel before them. A few months afterwards, they noticed that this hotel wasn't producing revenues, that suddenly it had gone from being in the black to being in the red. And so they called in some straight-up private investigators and asked them to make a proposal on how they would investigate this. And these investigators talked about using forensic accountants to look at the computers of the hotel, to go over the financial data and see where them if there was missing money, where it had gone. The second group that they called in was ex-CIA agents who said, well, we'll get this former owner's bank accounts, we'll get his telephone records, we'll have him searched every time he comes in or out of the United States, and that's how we'll turn him upside down and find the information you're looking for and the assets that you believe have gone missing.
Huh.
And what I found was that this sort of fits in a pattern where there are some of these ex-CIA agents who are on the up and up, that's for sure, but there are other groups that are willing to use all of their sort of clandestine skills that they employed for the government to go out and find this same information for private companies, even when it may break the law.
Let's talk about some of the techniques. Pretexting, this is what the CEO of Hewlett-Packard was accused of doing. What is pretexting? How does it work?
Pretexting involves calling up someone and pretending to be someone you're not. In the Hewlett-Packard case, it was private investigators calling up telephone companies and using very sophisticated techniques that they've developed over the years to convince these telephone companies to send the billing records for a reporter's phone records to a separate email account, to a new email account they've set up. And so suddenly the investigator has access to everyone I've called and everyone who's called me. So that's an easy example of pretexting, but it goes on many different levels. Often private investigators misrepresent themselves as freelance reporters or even as reporters for legitimate publications. I talked to a former senior official of the Central Intelligence Agency who runs a very up-and-up private investigative firm in New York, and he told me, as many did, that there's nothing wrong with pretexting. He said, if I pretend to be Doug France from Portfolio Magazine, that's wrong. That's against the law. I misrepresent you. But if I pretend to be Doug Smith from Portfolio Magazine, that's perfectly fine. That's an example of how pretexting works.
You talk about corporate spies who have up to 12 cell phones with different names, to the extent that the younger ones who aren't as schooled get confused about who they're supposed to be on what phone.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. A couple of former investigators with a private investigations firm based in New York talked about how they were trained by former CIA and former MI5 agents who were working for Diligence in how to set up false identities. They had false business cards which listed cell phone numbers, and then some of these guys would have 5 or 6 or 10 cell phones sitting on their desk, each one tagged to a different identity. So as you said, for some of the young guns working for this firm, it became very difficult to know which phone was which identity.
That's Doug France. His article in Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine describes this new world of corporate espionage, including, as we'll hear, how former agents have turned themselves into human lie detectors. Later today, want a flu shot with that hair product? Why many medical clinics are popping up at Walmart and CVS. Back in a minute with Doug, here and now. We're back with more from Douglas France. He's written an extensive article in Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine on this phenomenon of spies leaving agencies like the CIA and the KGB to work for corporations. Doug says, you know, it may be good for business, but he wonders if it's an erosion of privacy. Before the break, we were speaking about some of the techniques these agents have brought with them, pretexting, you know, faking an identity to get information, mining for emails. Some of what they do is perfectly legal, but some, Doug says, isn't. Doug, you also write about something called tactical behavior assessment. You say it falls somewhere between science and voodoo. You describe a scene with a former agent sitting at the elbow of an executive, kind of like an interpreter, and using this technique to figure out whether other people in that meeting are telling the truth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is one of the most fascinating aspects of what these former CIA agents are up to. And there's a firm in Boston called Business Intelligence Advisors, which was set up by some of the former senior officials from the CIA's Office of Security. And these are CIA agents who specialize in operating lie detectors. These CIA agents believe that they developed a set of 30 verbal signs and 30 physical signs that indicate when someone is lying. And so they set up this private operation in which they hire themselves out primarily to financial advisors and hedge funds, and they'll sit beside them at a conference call where there are analysts listening to the CEO of a particular company or the chief financial officer of a company talking about that company's prospects and how rosy everything is. And the idea is that these ex-CIA agents can recognize when this person is lying or veering away from the truth, and the CIA person will elbow the investment manager or the hedge fund boss, and that'll allow them to take up on that and perhaps ask additional questions. It's just one of the aspects that goes into determining whether you invest, whether you buy, whether you sell. Bill Gates is one of the people who uses these.
And tell us about the data haunt. This is using things like secretly installed software that records every keystroke on a computer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of my longtime acquaintances, I guess, is a former CIA agent who dabbles now in private investigative work, and he described for me first this concept of data haunts. And he said they use a Trojan horse. They'll send it over the Internet in an email to you. You open it up, and it'll put a virus into your computer so that it will monitor every stroke of your computer and transfer it back to these people. That's one aspect of data haunting. Another aspect of data haunting is where they'll pick up your cell phone calls, and even if they can't get all of the conversation on your cell phone call, they'll see who you're calling, and they'll see who's calling you on your mobile phone, and that'll give a sense, if you're a corporate executive, of who you might be talking to outside the company, who an investment target might be, who you might be thinking of hiring, what that says about the direction that your business is taking. Data haunts is a concept that is right on the line, I think. Some aspects of it are probably legal. One of the private investigators who used it described it to me as following behind someone on a superhighway, and they're in a convertible, and papers keep flying out of the convertible, and you're just there to pick them up as they do that.
Is there also concern that this is going to be a brain drain from the government?
Oh, it absolutely has been a brain drain. There's no question about that. Numerous people I talk to, both inside the CIA and outside the CIA, are concerned about the numbers of veteran agents who are leaving, who should be the senior managers of the Central Intelligence Agency, who should be the station chiefs in the hottest areas, and who should be heads of the analysis program, suddenly find themselves with kids going to college, with spouses who are unhappy about their peripatetic lifestyle, you know, and suddenly one of these private firms offers them $150,000, $200,000 a year. You can fly first class. You can hang out with your old buddies because there are a lot of them working for us. It becomes very attractive, and it's part of this privatization of intelligence that is potentially very dangerous to the Central Intelligence Agency at a time when the CIA is more necessary than ever to the safety and security of the United States.
You quote Robert Baer, who's the former agent, and he was the model for George Clooney's character in the film Syriana, as saying, you know, old-timers, the good guys who love the place, the CIA, are leaving because the culture is broken. So there's also disillusionment after 9/11 and all the questions raised about the CIA.
Yes, I think the CIA has a spotty track record. I think the last 40 or 50 years or so, really, since the end of World War II. But if it's going to get better, these are the kinds of people we need to keep in the agency, the Bob Baers of the world, if you will, the Milt Beardens, the John Kirikous. There's another person I quote in there who loved the CIA, loved his career there, but just found that the hours were too punishing and the demands were too heavy after September 11th for him to have any kind of life.
Well, and I want to mention him, because Kirikou is someone who came on everybody's radar in the last couple of weeks. He was the agent who went public about being part of an interrogation of a terrorism suspect and acknowledging that waterboarding was used in his interrogation.
He's a guy who spent, I think, 14 or 16 years with the Central Intelligence Agency. He was in Pakistan and played a central role in the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the planner of 9/11. And so he had a very promising career at the CIA, but he was the person who told me that, you know, despite how much he loved the agency, he realized that he couldn't have a family life if he continued to work there.
Well, he also seemed to be saying in interviews on the Today Show and elsewhere that he felt that the methods that were being used were torture. He says that now, and he was against them. So obviously some disillusionment there.
There's a whole wide range of disillusioned people at the Central Intelligence Agency, and they're unhappy about a lot of different things. And I hope that under Mike Hayden, things will begin to improve.
Douglas France, his article about corporate espionage appears in Portfolio Magazine. He's also co-author of The Nuclear Jihadist, the story of Pakistan's renegade nuclear scientist, AQ Khan. Douglas, thank you as always.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, are they going to be able to keep up this pace until next November? The presidential race moves on to South Carolina, Michigan, and beyond. We will get back in that race. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, is it fair to call it McMedicine, or is it a much-needed aid for the health industry? We'll take a look at the mini medical clinics that are springing up at CVS and Walmart. That's after the news, Here and Now. Talk about one-stop shopping. In some states, you can now buy school supplies and then find out if you have strep throat at a CVS or Walmart. It's called Convenient Care, mini healthcare clinics set up in existing stores. Walk-in patients able to see a nurse practitioner about a range of minor medical issues like ear infections, allergies, pink eye, even pregnancy tests. Generally, an MD is not on staff. Serious problems are referred to the emergency room or to a family doctor. Yesterday, CVS gained approval for their Minute Clinics here in Massachusetts. The company already has 466 of the walk-in clinics in 25 other states. Well, joining us on the line is Regina Hertzlinger. She's a professor at Harvard Business School. She's studied convenient care and thinks it's the wave of the future. Professor, what do you see driving the growth of these clinics?
It's very hard to get an appointment with the doctor, no matter how much the doctor may want to see you. And the emergency room is going to be a very long wait. And people work very hard. We think of ourselves as a Joe Sixpack society. But really, we have more two-career families. People work harder. We're among the hardest-working countries in the world. So people do not have the time to be patient.
And to be a patient.
Correct.
Well, that brings us to another facet of these clinics that supporters really applaud. They seem to be open at hours that are more available to workers.
Absolutely. They're open in some areas. They're open 7 days a week and from early in the morning until late at night so that people who work can actually get to them. And that's one of the big problems in our healthcare system. People cannot access needed care in a timely basis.
Well, we're going to get to some of the criticisms of the clinics in a moment, but how much do the visits cost? We spoke to the CEO of the Minute Clinics chain opening at CVS here in Massachusetts, and he said it's sometimes half the cost of a doctor's visit. We understand the costs are posted. They're pretty straightforward. What are some of them?
Well, in many states, Minute Clinic charges about $69 for a visit. It depends what is going on in the visit. And there are some other clinic models which actually use doctors rather than nurse practitioners. They clearly will charge more. But there's no question that these clinics are cheaper than going to an emergency room, cheaper by an enormous amount. Plus, from a social point of view, they free up the emergency room for really serious kinds of traumas, which is, after all, what the emergency room is for.
Well, and people who are going to those emergency rooms with things like a sore throat, many of them are on some kind of assistance and don't have a primary care physician that will accept them. So do these small clinics accept Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurance?
They certainly do. And you bring up a terrific point about Medicaid recipients. one of the big problems for Medicaid recipients is the traditional medical care system will not see a lot of them because Medicaid pays such poor rates. But for the clinic, those rates are totally acceptable.
But we understand that in these contracts that individual states have, not every state will accept Medicaid payments from at a mini clinic.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, you know, another criticism is that there's no doctor in attendance. There's no continuity of care. And that's especially a problem for children. A pediatrician can pick up a string of small symptoms and maybe find a big problem. But if a child visits three mini clinics, they may not connect those dots.
The clinics, because they're a chain, have excellent electronic medical records, and they send an electronic notice of what happened in that visit and the clinical findings to whoever the primary care physician may be. In the real world, however, as you say, many of the people who use these clinics don't have a primary care physician. So that to them, it's a choice between sitting in an emergency room next to a guy who's been shot by an Uzi or may have some infectious disease, or getting quick, convenient care in a mini clinic.
But we've seen reports, there's one in the Washington Post, of Spring Valley Pediatrics, which is a, you know, a private practice, and they claim that they had two children who were in their care who visited mini clinics and didn't get the antibiotics that should have been prescribed for strep throat and sinusitis in another case. She said there was also poor follow-up. Is there concern that it might be spotty?
I think there's concern, and very legitimate concern, about the entire medical care system, including pediatricians, about the spottiness of their quality of care and the lack of follow-up.
Well, what about some other concerns, just briefly? First of all, that there's a conflict of interest. These mini clinics are being set up in pharmacies, in CVSs and Walmarts that have pharmacies. And it might be, you know, on the other hand, it might be too convenient for them to prescribe pills that someone can just walk over and get then at the pharmacy counter.
It's legitimate. If these clinics are pushing pills, we don't want to have them. The only way to deal with that is to have disclosure. They should disclose how many of their patients are prescribed what kinds of medications in a depersonalized way and have that compared to comparable patients in other kinds of settings.
So something you feel and we should keep an eye on.
Absolutely.
And just one concern that came up in our office. These clinics might be driving sick people to stores where other shoppers are, you know, buying food stuff. And the idea that you might be, you know, buying something next to a group huddled group of people with the flu. Now, we know that there are sick people all around us all the time, but this might make it even more prominent that, you know, sick people will be in a public place.
It's a very good point. As anybody who's traveled on a plane, train, or bus, you know that coffer is sitting right next to you, so that's a concern we have everywhere. I think it is a legitimate concern, but the other side of it is that these people otherwise would likely go to an emergency room where they themselves would get much sicker.
Regina Hertzlinger, a professor at Harvard Business School, she's been studying convenient care, as these mini clinics are called. You know, obviously a supporter. And do you think that it's just a symptom, though, of a bigger problem?
I think the pushback against these clinics, and there are many varieties of them, is an example of the very pervasive turf warfare in the healthcare system, where parties, in this case physicians, believe that they own the patients and they'll put up all sorts of barriers against somebody else coming in to their turf. And those kinds of barriers are ultimately injurious to the American people who cannot get convenient care, cannot get cheap care, cannot get access to a primary care provider.
Someone commented that at these mini clinics, they sometimes have a time limit, 15 minutes per visit, and that was, you know, a big criticism. And I was reminded that my primary care physician at a major, wonderful hospital here in Boston has the same time limit.
Right.
Regina Hertzlinger, professor at Harvard Business School, thanks very much.
Thank you.
quickly, a couple stories we're working on for next week. Dr. Susan Wicklund is an abortion doctor, and she's now telling her story in the hopes of reminding people how many women have chosen this procedure. Also, why is Hillary Clinton the only Democrat on the primary ballot in Michigan? You're listening to Here and Now. Immigration will be a hot-button issue in tonight's Republican presidential debate because the setting is Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the largest tourism market in a state where tourism tops the economy and immigrant workers fuel that economy. But the temporary worker visas, the H-2B visas, those workers depend on, have been caught up in the ongoing immigration debate. We turn now to Pauline Levesque. She's chief executive of the Myrtle Beach Area Hospitality Association. And Pauline, these temporary worker visas have allowed workers into the Myrtle Beach area. What kinds of jobs are they doing?
They're doing jobs like maintenance on properties, cleaning rooms, some front desk staffing. They're doing jobs that during our peak season need to be filled.
And this has been going on for a while. We know business leaders in the area actually want the number of visas expanded to meet the need of, what, 14 million people who visit your city every year. Instead, there's been an annual cap on these visas. What do you think has happened here?
I think that while they looked at the temporary visa program as taking jobs away from the American public, the fact is there are no folks available to fill these positions. I did a survey of our membership, and last year, about 29% operated without all their jobs filled last summer.
And in fact, you say that with the number of immigrant workers that you have who come in with these temporary work visas, you still have jobs that are open that you can't fill with workers in this country. There are jobs available, just people not to work in them.
Exactly.
Well, while most of the immigration debate has been about fortifying borders and building the wall, we understand that visas are also a part of the illegal immigration problem, that people overstay their visas. Now, there's many different kinds of visas. What about the temporary worker visas? Are they abused? Is that a concern?
I think any program that exists at one point or another gets abused. These two particular programs, and I'm speaking of the J-1 visa program, which are for student workers, and the H-2B program, which has the cap of 66,000. I don't think they're abused as the others are. There are great controls in place. There are systems in place. These folks are sponsored by businesses and by nonprofit organizations to come here and work. They're monitored, and there's a strong reporting system in place should someone try to abuse.
Well, we understand another concern of business leaders in Myrtle Beach is, trying to police immigration, trying to, if people have documents, trying to, do more research to figure out if they are valid. Candidate Mitt Romney has been very tough on immigration and asking for reform, but he was attacked by Mike Huckabee at one of the debates for having illegal workers at his home here in Massachusetts. And Romney replied, "What do you want me to do? Check all their papers?" And does that feel ironic to you? Because isn't that what
it does?
You are also
saying. That's what every business person does on a daily basis. We agree. We do not want illegal immigration. We do not want anyone breaking the law. But those of us that continue to follow the law, they're not certain they have not hired an illegal person. The process is you take all the information. If they provide you authentic-looking documentation, there's no way not to know if it is or it isn't until you submit it. And then the person's working, the process is it's filed, and at some point if in the process through the government they find out that the person's illegal, they have to notify the employer, and the employer, by law, is required to notify the employee that their documentation was invalid or there was a problem with the documentation. And if that person then is illegal, they either just don't show up for the meeting or they take off and they're working in some other state. So to say that, the majority of businesses are hiring illegals knowingly is really a false statement.
Pauline Levesque is chief executive of the Myrtle Beach Area Hospitality Association. Pauline, is it safe to say you and other business people will be watching pretty closely tonight?
We certainly will. And what we would say to anyone who's got any authority into implementing anything new is to make sure whatever system you put into place, the business doesn't become the agency that now is an enforcement agency. It's not the role of business to do that.
Pauline, thanks.
You're welcome.
And by the way, South Carolina Republicans hold their primary on Saturday, January 19th. South Carolina Democrats vote on January 26th. Let's take a look at some more of the primaries coming up. Michigan is next on Tuesday, January 19th. Nevada has precinct caucuses. Florida is January 29th. February 1st, Maine has their Republican primary. February 5th, Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, New Jersey, New York, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Utah, Georgia, Delaware, Connecticut. That's why they call it Super Duper Tuesday. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Como vida sa no Zimbabwe. Quero também contigo, Zimbabwe.
Sara Tavares singing about balance, something she's familiar with. She struck a balance between her African roots in Cape Verde and European upbringing in Lisbon, between the soul music she loved as a child and the gospel churches where she learned her craft. Balance is the title of her new CD, and Sara Tavares joins us with more. Welcome.
Hello.
You're singing in Criollo? Am I pronouncing that correct?
Yes, perfect. Criollo and Portuguese.
What is that? Is it like our Creole?
A bit. It's like broken Portuguese, but it has also bits of African languages that I don't know about them. But, you know, Cape Verde were desert islands when the Portuguese got there, and they brought in the slaves from all the west coast of Africa. So it's the mix of all these people trying to communicate that created the Criollo language.
And, you know, you're a bit of a mix yourself. Your professional story, I understand, began on a show in Portugal. That's a lot like our American Idol here in the U.S.
Yeah, it's true. I did an impression of Whitney Houston. At the time, I was a big fan of her.
The greatest love of all, if I'm remembering correctly. Was it? I mean, did you really do the greatest? I mean, did you do the full Whitney?
I was a teenager. I used to listen to her the whole day and just, you know, try to imitate her. So I was a really big fan, and I still have a big love for her, for what she meant for so many young black girls across the world.
What did she mean for you?
Joy. She was beautiful, and all the glamour around her allowed us to dream about having, you know, colors in our life too.
Huh. Well, we don't want to make this about Whitney Houston, but she's been having a rough time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that she's just becoming a deeper soul. I adore to hear her singing gospel music, and I'm sure that she's every day becoming a really deeper gospel minister.
Huh. Let's talk about who you are, because you were 14 years old just then, so young. And part of your story that accompanies you wherever you're written about is that, well, it's put different ways, that you had been abandoned by your parents, that you were living with an aunt, that you weren't with your family. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, my parents, they were immigrants from the Cape Verde Islands, and they were, you know, trying to see if they could get a better life in Portugal. And then they had to move on. My mother, she moved to the south of the country, and my father went back to the Cape Verde Islands, so I was never abandoned. Yes, I was left behind. I was brought up by a Portuguese old lady, but I always kept contact with my parents. So
that's much better than how it reads sometimes in the
stories.
Yeah,
people like to make it dramatic.
But why couldn't you go with them? They think it was a better life for you?
I think they were starting all over again, you know, many times. So they wanted to just leave me in a place where I could have some constants, you know, in life.
Well, I want to listen to some more of you. Bomb feeling?
Bomb feeling, that's bomb great feeling. Accent.
Thank you. Good feeling, it borrows heavily from the Cape Verde and the African influence. Let's listen.
Deixa de complicação, deixa de confusão. Liberta a alma dessa prisão, uai, deixa te guiar pelo coração.
Tell us about the playing.
For me, my songs are like lullabies for myself, me as an adult. So it's me taking the guitar and, you know, and making myself, my soul, you know, softer. Give some tenderness to myself. It's all about that. So I do have a very simple way to play the guitar.
You just picked it up yourself?
Yeah, by listening to my colleagues and albums and records. I think that the rhythms that I play are a bit more complicated, but even for me, I'm not able to explain them. They just come out naturally.
Well, and as we said, you grew up in Lisbon, and you have this, as you said, the sense of loneliness.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
perfect candidate for fado music.
which
brings us to your collaboration with fado singer Ana Mora, who's been on our program.
Wow.
What is the pull for fado? And it, actually, for some who haven't heard it, how would you describe it?
Ooh, soulful music. Very ancient, but it's still up to date because people still feel that melancholic in Portugal. And I love that kind of music because we always have great singers, and the words and the lyrics, they really come from the hearts of people who really feel life in a deeper way. I love fado, and it has a North African influence into it, you know, the way that they put the vocals. And I think it's one of the treasures of Portuguese culture.
Let's listen to you singing De Nua.
De Nua, yeah.
With Ana Mora.
De boa criatura, de boa formosura,
So Sarah Tavares, how much was gospel an influence on you?
It's a really big influence. I think they have the greatest singers on earth, you know, because they sing with their spirits to get across all life's difficulties and can help us to fly, really.
Any conflict then? Because you also sing, you know, with rappers, and do any conflicts present themselves to you?
No. I always sing about overcoming, being positive and constructive about life.
Let's listen to Pocatera. This is with the rapper Melo D. What's the meaning of the words that we're about to hear?
Pocatera is the way that we do as children to make a train. We say Pocatera, Pocatera, woo woo, de Pocatera, Pocatera, woo woo.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Olha o comboio vai a passar. Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Acorda, manena, apanhas do ar. Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Olha o comboio vai a passar. Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Pocatera, woo woo.
That's fun. Oh, it's international too. Every child plays the train.
Yeah, yeah.
Who would you like to sing with?
There are so many wonderful artists around. Some are already gone, and some are still around, and some are still to come. I'm a huge fan of Stevie Wonder, for example. But I think I would just listen to him because he's magic, magic in action. Miriam Makeba, she's a great African singer. I love her.
Whitney.
Yeah, I don't feel in the same contest as I used to do, you know. I like to sing in my own language. I like to celebrate my own identity and you know, to sing a lot about the other part of the ocean, you know, what's across there. We all love American music, you know, either pop or R&B or blues or whatever. But I think that the world needs to get to know other things too. And I want to celebrate that other part of the world so that we can get balance in the world, you know.
You want to be you.
Yes.
Yeah, not Whitney Houston anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned all the influences, American fado, pop, Brazilian music, and I think maybe one pulls it together. It's Giza, so maybe we'll listen to that as we go. And what does that mean?
Lament.
Again. Back to the lament. Sarah Tavares, her new CD is called Balance. For more on the music, go to our website, here-now.org. Sarah, thanks so much. It was so nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, too.
Cadê? Nada mais pra mim. Nem princípio, nem fim. Perdem a raiz. Simbolo. O que fomo, o que se toca, será. Me diz adiante. Diga na mim. O que fomo, o que se toca, será. Minha alma, minha. Quebrado um grito. chiesa di mamma, chiesa di papà, ah, yeah. C'ero grandi nel mondo.